The discussion of how Federal Reserve notes, in essence, make you a slave. We went quite extensively into what's going on with that, and what we wanted to do is follow up on that notion. Basically, what can you do about it? Good evening, Jeff. How are you doing today?
Very good. And I want to thank everyone who called in earlier today and yesterday. I had a very fun time tied to my telephone.
Well, it's always great when we can make some positive impact and awaken people and help them solve these problems. So that's what we want to continue doing on this evening. Jeff, you know, we're talking about being free. We're talking about getting away from the system. There's a notion out there. It's called state citizenship. Tell me your feelings on that.
Well, a lot of people in the Patriot community were touting the idea that there were two types of citizenship, federal citizenship and state citizenship, and that one was superior to the other. The often quoted site is the Slaughterhouse Cases out of Louisiana, where they imply that the citizenship rights, privileges, and immunities of the state citizen, by virtue of them preceding the 14th Amendment U.S. citizen, were superior in some aspects. But what most people don't check is the definition of the word citizen itself. And it's plain that anyone who is a citizen has submitted himself to the dominion of government. And if you scratch your head and say, if you're into sovereignty, then how can you also submit yourself to the sovereignty of a government? It's mutually exclusive. So what's really going on is that if you really want to go into sovereignty, you don't want to claim state citizenship. But if you so choose, you can join the political club. And you can choose whether you want to assert state citizenship or federal citizenship.
Okay.
But both are the same, pretty much, when it comes to your rights, privileges, and immunities.
So basically, state citizenship is taking advantage of some loopholes. That there's some things that are not in place that to control a state citizen but do control federal citizens.
In some respects, yes. Prior to the bankruptcy, a U.S. citizen, by virtue of the federal jurisdiction, allowed the federal government to come into the state on behalf of the federal citizen. Prior to the adoption of the 14th Amendment, the federal government had very little to do in the state. And if you look at Title 42, where a lot of the cases people have filed Title 42, Section 1983, suits for deprivation of rights under color of law, that authority comes from the 14th Amendment. Some people claim that if you're a state citizen, you really don't want to file under Title 42. And from what I've seen of the courts, I'd rather not file in courts at all and look for non-judicial remedies. Because, see, a citizen is one, again, who's exercising political rights. He is engaged in running for office or electing the people, and for that privilege, he is required to pay the bill. And if you read the earliest constitutions of the 13 colonies, they did expressly state that if you wanted to be a voter, you had to prove you paid your taxes. And they never had a penalty for not paying taxes. All they did was not let you vote, which made sense.
Mm-hmm.
If you're going to decide how the money is spent, you're going to ante up the money. Now, the people who did not bother with government, the free inhabitants who are not citizens, who did not register to vote, did not run for office, were pretty much left alone. And the powerful document of the Articles of Confederation are very explicit. They state in Article 4 that the free inhabitants have all the privileges and immunities of free citizens. So if government bestows any special privilege to its people, if you're a free inhabitant, you have it also. So I feel that being an inhabitant is superior to being a citizen. where you enjoy all the privileges and immunities, but you're not bound by obligation to perform.
Okay, that's a very valid point. Another thing that's a real big to-do that a lot of people are thinking is going to have effect is something called a constitutional or common law court. It's not just that easy, is it?
Well, I checked some research, and God bless folks out there trying to do something to get around the logjam that the court system has, but the Federalist Papers are quite clear that prior to the adoption of the Constitution, there were common law courts in the country. And in fact, Georgia had nothing but common law courts. Yet when I read the Georgia Encyclopedia of Law, it said that at the adoption of the Constitution, all common law courts in Georgia were abolished. So that begs the question, how can you have a constitutional common law court when the Constitution abolishes them?
Very good point. That's why, you know, it's great that you've done the research and taken it that step further where everybody else sees something that appears to be obvious and you're looking a little bit past the obvious, and we find out about a lot of interesting things when we do that. All right. We're out of debt. Where houses are sold, if it's not sold, if we've got businesses, we've found an appropriate trust. We've gotten ourselves in a position where we can start becoming free. Where do we start?
Well, again, you're pointing out that you yourself are free. You're no longer property of someone else. You've established your own freehold, your own property where your house is and your...
Well, let's look at it this way. We've discharged debts. We've eliminated our contractual obligations to banking systems. We've closed our bank accounts.
Right. You got out of their clutches, and you got rid of your Social Security number.
Well, no, we haven't done that yet.
We have not done
Where do we go after we get rid of our debts, after we get out of, after we close our bank accounts? Where do we want to start in this whole game?
Probably the easiest thing to do is to surrender the benefits that you, by accident, took from the government. The biggest accident everyone makes is sign up for Social Security. And again, each case is unique. I applied when I was 16, definitely under legal age, so I can claim as part of my reasons why I want to get rid of this is that I was underage, fraud was perpetrated upon me, material facts were withheld, and I never knowingly, intentionally, or willingly waived my rights, privileges, or immunities in exchange for charity from the public treasury. Now, I'd send back the documents if I had them. If not, I'd notify them that they were lost, and I would renounce any claim to future benefits. At that point, I have no legal claim to charity from the public treasury, and therefore I'm no longer a pauper.
Mm-hmm.
And I would avoid that status at all costs, because if you are a pauper, or any of the other impaired statuses, government is excused from any constitutional limitations when it comes to your rights.
And this is a hard one that people are going to have a real tough time swallowing. Oh, I've been paying into Social Security for 30 years. This is not for everyone. This is for people that are willing to step out and take responsibilities for themselves, that recognize the truth, and are ready to make the commitment. That's a very important thing for people to consider. As Jeff can attest to, it is not an easy road to hoe, is it, Jeff?
No. It does take a lot of dedication. And in one sense, you're going to be eternally vigilant to protect your rights and also to help your neighbors protect their rights. Because if you don't look out for your neighbor, then you're in dire straits. In one sense, when you have a group of people who are willing to take responsibility and keep track of the Indians coming over the hill or the pirates parking their boats down in your harbor, you're going to feel a lot more safe than if you try to rely on government-paid policemen. Because the bottom line is, the Supreme Court ruled that the police are under no obligation to protect you. The bottom line is, you need to pledge yourself to help protect your neighbor. And that's good policy.
Yeah, that's the way this country used to be. That's what it was, the guidelines it was founded under. All right, it's my understanding, and I don't know, maybe you can validate this, that the Social Security Administration even has a form for rescinding your contract with them. Have you heard anything about that?
The only thing I saw was in a case where you applied for benefits and you made a mistake and you decided that you were going to go back to work or something, that it was a revocation of application for benefits.
Okay.
But as far as I know, there is no express document for backing out of the system. Of course, they don't know anything about it, the staff themselves, and there's nothing that I could find in the Code of Federal Regulations that explicitly said this is how to get out.
Mm-hmm.
But I was in one court case where I asserted that I did not have a valid number, and I asked the judge to produce the document with my valid signature. Otherwise, don't presume that I have a number.
Mm-hmm.
And he followed it.
Well, he has no choice on it.
That's right.
One of the things that you've pointed out in previous discussions is produce a document with my bona fide signature. Now, even if they came up with that document and it had a signature, bona fide, there's a legal twist in that.
That's right. In fact, if they asked you, is that your signature on the document, you'd say no. Or they'll say, is that your ink on the paper? And you'll say, yeah. Is that your name? Yeah. Is that your signature? No. The reason being, a signature means you knowingly, willingly, and intentionally made that agreement. And when they perpetrate a fraud, you certainly did not do it intentionally.
It's like the argument traveling versus driving. It's one of those things that you need to be very knowledgeable about before you embark on this endeavor, is being well-versed in these little subtleties.
Right.
Because you don't want to get caught in a trap.
The government has trained us to think in a new language that is devoid of real meaning. If you go back to, say, an 18th or 19th century dictionary, you'd be surprised how clear the terminology is, that pretty much the terms in law fit in with the language. But over time, our modern language twisters have made us pretty much functionally illiterate when it comes to the law.
Mm-hmm.
The media keeps talking about so-and-so who resides at, who is a resident of, or whose residence was burned down. And they never use the proper legal terms, because a resident is a transient by law. He does not have a permanent home. A person who is an inhabitant has a domicile, not a residence. And so, again, they build this false language, and so you go into a court or into a legal action, and you shoot yourself in the foot.
Exactly. And I still have many police contacts, and what we're seeing here in the Phoenix area is more and more people that are doing this, that are getting out, that are taking their license plates and turning them back in, or not their license plates, the state's license plates, and they're driving around with bills of sale.
Mm-hmm.
And the police now are being trained to ask, where were you driving? So, you know, just one of those little things. If they can get a guy to admit he was driving, they've got him.
That's right.
Okay, and they're tape recording this conversation, and they go to the judge, well, Your Honor, he said he was driving. Define driving.
That's correct.
Okay, go ahead and define driving for people so they're clear on the differences.
The term drive implies that you're in the business of hauling cargo or passengers for hire. And generally, when you register your private automobile as a motor vehicle, you've made a declaration that that is an instrument used in commerce. Therefore, since it's commercial, you are obligated by your state's commercial rules of the road. And that means you need a licensed driver to operate it. However, there is a little get-out-of-jail-free section in every state's code. It's called the non-resident driving privilege. A non-resident of the state, now I'm going to presume all states grant non-residents the privilege to go through the state. The key is, if you can assert that you're a non-resident, it's obvious you cannot get a license or register your automobile in the state if you're a non-resident. They cannot apply their laws to you.
Okay.
By getting a speeding ticket in a foreign state, all they can do is complain to your home state, and even then, I was able to beat tickets years ago when I did have a license.
Mm-hmm. So, again, it's all part and parcel of really knowing what's going on before you make the step. You know, you don't want to rush into things, and then all of a sudden you find yourself locked up. It's like, you can't do this. Well, yes, as a matter of fact, we can, but, you know, you need to know what you're doing before you take these steps. All right, Social Security Administration, you told them, here's your number back. Thank you, I don't need this any longer. How many times and how many different agencies does this really need to be done to?
Now, that's something that a lot of different arguments come out. I've seen people who claim that you're supposed to contact the president on down. I feel that the cheapest and easiest thing to do is, if you're involved in any court action, that they're suing you upon some document, I just ask the judge, please present the document with a bona fide signature, and if you don't have one, don't presume it exists. And by putting it right in their face, by asserting your status that you own yourself and your property, and that you're not pledged to anyone else, nor are you a trustee of a trust that's named to you, they're stuck, because all their presumptions are based on you silently consenting to their presumptions.
Acquiescing to their jurisdiction.
Exactly. And the nastiest trick they do is bring you into an arraignment, and most people do not know what the arraignment process is. I had the fortune of talking to a great researcher up in Michigan, and he spelled out what they were really doing, and sure enough, I checked his claims, and they were accurate. He said, go to any Black Law Dictionary and look up the word arraignment. And just before it, there was the word arraign. And as you go through every word in that definition and track down all the words that tie to it, you come to the conclusion that all the government does is offer you the option to move out of a judicial hearing into an inferior tribunal. And the arraignment is the first step. If we don't object to it and demand a judicial probable cause hearing, we've already lost our case.
Again, very important that you know what's going on and you educate yourself and you learn before you take these steps. Okay, so we've got Social Security. We're educating ourselves in regards to when they have jurisdiction. Some things that pop up fairly frequently is, and, you know, obviously when people endeavor on this, they're going to cross paths with the IRS. And they're going to start getting notices from the IRS, and they're going to take them and file them in their circular file. Then all of a sudden they're going to get those little, you know, notices that come down to the post office and sign for something. Do people need to sign for those?
Well, let me back up a second. The first presumption you're making is the IRS sends you something, they first need your address.
Mm-hmm.
If you have an address that identifies you in a federal mailbox, you're in trouble right there. My location where mail can be delivered is general delivery, and that is a non-domestic location. If I'm non-domestic to the United States, then the IRS cannot bill me for being internal to the United States. They hate that. In fact, the local IRS went so far as to call me up to invite me down for a meeting and then serve me with a summons because they couldn't mail it to me. So I refused it for cause, and I called up to make a meeting with the next level up. Went down, they did the same thing. They canceled the meeting and just handed me a summons. Boy, they're desperate.
Mm-hmm.
So I refused that for cause, and again, they're stuck because they can't mail it to me. I don't have an address.
Okay. Again, differences in words, address. Okay. People are going to look at a lot of, I've seen such bizarre attempts at, you know, listing a place for mail delivery. What is really and truly necessary, and what are the differences?
Okay. By the terminology, and I'm a very careful nitpicker, I know the words. Think about this. If you get general delivery, that's where it goes to the main post office branch. You go in there and say, hi, Postmaster so-and-so, I want my mail. My name is Joe Schmo, go check. They go check and say, yep, no mail for you, Joe Schmo. See you next time. You walk away. Now, if that's general delivery, what would be the opposite of general, special or specific? So all the mailboxes in the country, even the post office boxes, are presumed non-general or special, and you pay extra for that. And the government, according to the United States Postal Regulations, can only do special delivery within the United States government. That's why the mailbox is federal territory, and you can only put federal mail in there. Now, what they love to do is presume, since you associate yourself with that federal box location, you live there. They ask you, is that your address? You say, yeah, okay. So Joe Schmo, the corporation, has its offices located in that, where communications can reach that artificial person there. But real people don't need addresses. Conversely, all privileges from government first need you to have an address. It's really hard to get a driver's license without an address in the state. In fact, it's impossible. So everything tied to what the government wants or bestows in benefits first requires an address, but free people don't need addresses. So again, if you get yourself halfway out, they still can smack you over the head, but if you get all the way out, they can't find you.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have an address. In fact, in Georgia Code, it says that they can issue a warrant for statutory offenses if you don't have an address in the state.
A lot of people use care of and postal code. What is that effectively doing?
Well, the care of really doesn't change anything. The bottom line is, if you need to use a box or mail drop near you, have private address to an artificial entity. If people wrote to me at Church of the Living Word, that's fine. They're not addressing it to me, they're addressing it to the church. And that's an artificial entity, and that's fine. They can live in the paper world. The real me, my mail goes general delivery. In the same sense, once you get out of their privileges and benefits, you're no longer required to pay. In fact, the general delivery rate is only 2 cents per half ounce. That's even better than nonprofit.
Mm-hmm. Now, there's a difference between Georgia State and the Federal District of Georgia. Now, you know, there are a lot of these people that are out of the system. Do you need to address to them, or do they need to address them, and is it a constant that things need to say to be spelled out or the archaic abbreviation? I mean, what sort of potential problems might you get into if somebody sends you inadvertently, not even thinking, and just goes ahead and puts GA on there?
Well, again, that identifies a post office. It does not identify me. Their codes are fine in their addresses. Remember that only the post office makes addresses. And for proof of that, you can go to any post office and ask for the international reply card. It's a pink card. And it's quite interesting. The word address is not on it. See, address presumes inside the government, and they cannot presume an international location since within a government. It says plainly, house number and street, city, state, country, etc., but it does not use the word address. Now, if the international card on both sides will not use that magic phrase, but the green U.S. Postal Service card does, makes you wonder. They can't find it expressly put into clear terms. But if you look at the pink card, it says it's the Postal Service of the United States of America, but the green card says it's the United States Postal Service.
So, basically, is it all that important when a lot of these people are listing the township they live in?
No.
And they're listing...
That's not a federal address. See, all addresses are created by the federal government. What they're putting on is extraneous information, and it will not help deliver their mail. Either they're getting general or they're getting special delivery. And, you know, if they're going with these 9-digit zip codes where I think there's supposed to be a new one that's going to have 11 digits that will expressly identify the box, wherever the mailbox is, and that's all you need. You don't even have to put any other information. That's fine. If that's just identifying the box, if when they presume you live in that box, that there's a problem.
So basically, by placing care of on there, you're distancing yourself?
I'm not so sure. If they can get the mail to you, they don't care if it's a care of or Georgia or whatever. Their key is that they need you to have an address. I was in one deposition, and the two attorneys were pulling their hair out because they were trying to get me to admit I had an address. And the one attorney goes, well, what's your address? I don't have an address. Well, where do you sleep at night? In a bed. Well, where do you get your mail? In an envelope. And I just have them going around and around.
Mm-hmm.
And they were desperately trying to get me to admit to an address. And I suspect it's due to these simple facts that the artificial entities, through birth certificates and whatnot, are presumed to have addresses within government because you can't get those benefits and privileges without it.
Mm-hmm.
For the folks that want to go to the post office, the form number is 2865 for that pink return receipt for international mail.
Okay.
It's very interesting. You read that thing.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's nice. Again, what I'm trying to get at here is what lengths do people really need to go to? Is it best to just have a general delivery?
If you're going all the way out, yes. Mm-hmm. General delivery for your person, and if you have an artificial entity or trust that happens to get mail at your place, that's fine.
Mm-hmm.
And people that are transferring title to their houses to trust, that's fine. You can get the trust mail at that location and have your official mail, anything dealing with the government, come through and go to your general delivery.
So threat, duress, and coercion, TDC, and all that, it really isn't protecting you from anything?
No, it's not.
Okay, it's just taking up a lot of ink and space and targeting you as someone who's extremely militant. Okay, fair enough.
Yeah.
All right, next step. Where are we going from here? We don't have addresses. We're doing everything the right way. IRS still says, you know, there's something that comes, and even if it comes general delivery, and it's from the IRS. Do we sign for that, or don't we?
Well, you could refuse it for cause. That's the wrong address. you don't have one, so it's a good enough excuse, and send it back. Generally, most of the mail that the IRS sends is confirmatory writings, trying to get you to agree that you do owe something. I wish there was a silver bullet that always beat them. But the best thing is if you can't appear in their computers, that's, you know, number one.
But you're already there. You know, you've been there for 20, 30 years, you're getting out. You're bound to have problems.
Generally, yes.
How can we minimize problems?
Minimize problems? Send them a simple letter. I believe in paying all my taxes. Which tax are you talking about? I can't figure it out. Will you please help me?
Show me in statute.
Yeah. What tax? Now, if they say it's the U.S. individual income tax, you say, what? Thank you. Pursuant to 26 CFR 1.1-1, what form do you want me to file? And they'll say, 1040. You say, thank you, but I'm confused. Pursuant to 26 CFR 1.1-1, says the proper form to use is Form 2555, Foreign Earned Income. Are you telling me to file a false form? At that point, they pucker up a little. And if they aren't, then please show me where I'm supposed to file a 1040, because the law says otherwise.
Okay, so we're getting them to spin their wheels. There's more than likely, at some point in time or other, somebody's probably going to have to go into an IRS office. Now, I don't remember exactly how the phrase goes, but there's a biblical phrase, you want to be as wise as a serpent, and you can finish that off for me.
Yeah, well, gentle as a dove, wise as a serpent, I believe.
Okay.
But I tried that twice going in for appointments, and I had a stack of wonderful documentation, and after the first question, they shut the meeting down. But I said to myself, this is going nowhere.
Now, you can take a tape recorder of these things.
Yes, you give them 10 days notice in advance.
Written, is it not?
Yes, that they require. There have been several people who've been trying to use material that Eddie Kane out of Florida has been helping folks with. And, he's apparently been having some success, but the IRS is starting to catch on already, and they've changed their procedures. When you try to maintain control of the meeting and say, well, I called the meeting, they'll say, no, we called it. I said, wait a minute, let the record state that I called and I made the appointment because I have some questions about this tax you claim I owe. And they jump all over your case and you say, well, what tax do you want me to pay? And they'll say, U.S. individual income tax. And I'll say, well, according to your documentation here in the Code of Federal Regulations, it's Form 2555. Meeting's over. That's it. So you get really far with these guys. They're so helpful.
And at that point in time, where would that meet? Let's say a meeting like that occurred. Where would you be from the system standpoint?
Well, you could ask for their supervisor and immediately file a complaint with them. And if that supervisor won't do anything, then ask for the supervisor's supervisor and just climb up the ladder, keep filing complaints. And that's about as far as most people get. They get stonewalled and send complaints.
At some point in time, the IRS is going to figure it out that maybe we don't want to mess with this guy anymore.
Hopefully that's the case. Generally, we're in a tough situation because the actual methodology or the instrumentality that gets you into an obligation to pay the tax is hidden. First off, the Social Security number is one of the keys that gets you into jurisdiction. For, I believe it's 26 United States Code. I can't think of the number off the top of my head. I think it's 3227 or somewhere around there under the Social Security part that mentions no matter whom you work for or where you work, if you have an agreement with Social Security, it is presumed to be covered employment, taxable. Then, with that number, you have an account number with the Secretary of Treasury, and the presumption is, since you are getting pension money from the public treasury, you're presumed to be an employee of the United States government for tax purposes. So now you see how they can use the employee designation for anyone with a Social Security number. But it's pretty clever on how they get you to have the obligation to file a form. Turns out when you open a bank account, you agree to abide by the rules of the bank. And one of those rules is you agree to provide an annual financial form in the financial statement in the form we request. I'm quoting verbatim from an application for a Visa card that I got from one bank. And I never read the fine print before, and I saw that and my jaw hit the floor. I thought, oh, there it is.
1040.
Annual financial statement.
Yes.
1040.
That's why you can't have a bank account. It all comes together. This is how it's all, the web has been woven, and we've been lied to and manipulated and the rest of it, and people never bother to read the fine print.
That's correct.
And people need to get in the habit of doing that. And because, you know, once you do get out of the system and you do become free, you have to be extremely careful that you don't enter into such an agreement.
That's right.
You know, basically, it's my understanding that you can get out because a lot of the fraud has been perpetrated. But if you get out and then you inadvertently put yourself back in, you're in a world of hurt, aren't you?
Well, no, you have to intentionally join up.
Well, that's what I mean.
Yeah, you cannot be defrauded into it a second time. I mean, if someone pulls a scam on you or tricks you, you just denounce the fraud. In other words, just say that officer says, are you driving, where are you driving to? And you say, down to the mall, and then they bring that in the court. Well, he admitted he was driving. No, objection, that was a mistake. Just denounce it. Denounce it. Say, that's a mistake.
Mm-hmm.
I was traveling, and I was frightened because this man with a gun was by my car making threatening symbols and noise.
Mm-hmm.
Just stand your ground.
Yeah, and that's, you know, the most important thing. If we recognize they only have the power that we acquiesce to them.
He does not witness a genuine felony. He has really no authority to do a warrantless arrest. And when an officer comes up to you, it's always consensual. He's going to ask you, may I see, or may I have, or what is. It'll never be, I demand, produce, because he has no authority to do that. If it was a true arrest based upon a warrant, he doesn't need you to identify yourself. He's already got the warrant. And if there isn't any warrant, you are under no duty to give evidence that might incriminate you, and given your name is.
Mm-hmm. Now, a lot of cops, it's not that they are very polite. They don't ask. They just say, give me your driver's license. They make it, they place it as an order.
Mm-hmm. Well, I would always ask, is that a request or a command? And if the officer says it's a command, I'd say, thank you. Pursuant to the Fourth Amendment, would you please produce your authority, that is a warrant based upon a sworn affidavit where the injured party identifies my property or myself, making you authorized to order me. You don't have that? Oh, I'm sorry, officer. Then you're in your private capacity, and I have the right to sue you for damages. And I really like you, and I don't want to see you in trouble, and I don't want to take your car and your kids' toys and your nice house from your wife. Do you really want to order me? And if they say yes, well, say, thank you. I could use a new house.
Again, it's all part of being well-read, understanding, and taking this from soup to nuts, and not just jumping into it and sending off all these things to the Social Security Administration and the rest of it. You need to know where things have gone wrong before you make this step.
Yeah.
So it requires a, you know, very conscious effort. You need to be very cautious about that.
Yeah. And be very nice and polite. I mean, you know, the good, hardworking public servants do not need you to swear at them. And I had one deputy sheriff try to serve papers on me, and I was very polite. I asked her, is that a request or a command? And she said it was a request, and I respectfully denied her request and shut the door in her face.
Mm-hmm.
She never came back, so.
Well, I mean, she can't. You know, again, you don't acquiesce to their jurisdiction, then they have no jurisdiction over you.
That's correct.
Don't change your status at law by volunteering things.
Yeah, and remember that nasty word license is permission to commit a crime. And if you're not involved in committing a crime, why are you getting a license?
Exactly. We have the situation in the state of Arizona with firearms. We're an open carry state. Provided it's visible, you can carry a gun just about anywhere. There's only a couple restrictions. Now all of a sudden people are applying for concealed weapons licenses. They're giving up a right for a privilege.
That's correct. And really the only people required to get those permits are government employees.
Mm-hmm.
Because the public servant has a lower status. All police officers do get carry permits, do they not?
It's you don't need a permit. When you're in law enforcement, it's a department policy. You know, some departments say, no, you won't carry a gun off duty. Most say you will.
Mm-hmm.
And
they grant you permission.
Exactly.
Right. See, government officials need permission.
Mm-hmm.
And according to that old Article 4, any privilege granted to government and their citizens, you have.
Okay. So it's not all that complicated getting out. It's just it's a matter of knowing the intricacies and the ins and outs. And even that's not all that difficult. You just need to be aware of things. You just need to have a black flaw. And you need to know what words mean so you don't trip yourself up.
Yeah, especially in any courtroom situation, when a judge asks you a question, your hackles should raise, the red flags and the fireworks should go up, because a judge is supposed to be a referee, not the prosecutor. So when he starts asking you questions, he's setting you up. Any way, shape, or form, when a judge talks, you're in trouble.
Judge asks the question. What should your response be?
Yeah, like, for instance, I had one situation when I was fighting a domestic relations action when I defeated a child support order. The judge asked me, after I'd shown that the sole authority of the Pennsylvania law to force involuntary servitude was the Social Security number, he goes, well, were you married? And I should have said, there was no document before this court with my bona fide signature. But, you know, being on the spot and making mistakes like anybody else, I said, I was divorced. He banged the gavel and he cracked the biggest smile and said, I'm going to really violate your rights. Pay up or go to jail.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I scratched my head and I was doing research. I found that sure enough, yeah, a marriage license is evidence of impaired status. Because free people don't need licenses. They don't need permission to get married.
Exactly. One of the things, as I go through different legislative research and the rest of it to see what they're up to in Washington, D.C., anytime they introduce a law, it's very interesting, a statement that is made, in Congress assembled. That has a specific meaning, doesn't it?
Yes. In fact, in the Articles of Confederation, the second article defines that the powers Congress has, or excuse me, all the powers delegated to the United States, comma, in Congress assembled. So those terms are synonymous, the phrase United States and the phrase in Congress assembled. And that identifies that foreign corporation based in Washington, D.C.
So
when Congress is not assembled, there is really no United States in session.
So basically the United States only exists starting with in Congress assembled.
Yeah, and that's with the authority. Now, once they enact a law, then they pass the authority to the president to enforce it. So when Congress dismisses itself, the president, who is, according to the Constitution, president of the United States of America, not of the United States, and then they pass that authority so that it covers all 50 states and federal territory.
Maybe you ought to, most of the people that listen to the hour at the time are familiar with these concepts, but there's some that aren't. Maybe you ought to elaborate on that a little bit.
If you read Article 1, Article 2, and Article 3, you'll recognize that Congress is the Congress of the United States. That's, of course, the private corporations. And in Article 3, the Supreme Court is also the Supreme Court of the United States. But the president, he is not president of the United States. He is president of the United States of America. So Congress and the Supreme Court's limited jurisdiction and focus is within the government, within government territory, whereas the president is authorized to exercise powers anywhere in pursuance to the Constitution and the Articles. In fact, if pirates invade California, the president doesn't have to wait for Congress to give him authority, nor does he have to wait for California. He can go act to defeat the pirates because that's in the contract. But he doesn't have the authority to go interfere anywhere else.
Mm-hmm. Now, which brings us around to what's going on with our troop deployments. How are they getting around that? What are they doing here that, besides violating the spirit of the law?
Well, according to my Constitution copy, Congress is supposed to enact, spend money to protect Americans. And I don't know how many Americans are in danger over there in Herzegovina and Serbia and Bosnia. So I suspect that they may be using some other reason, and the smoking gun is in the hands of the creditor. Because we all know that the government was first saying, it's a UN action, but when Michael New and others started complaining that they were not going to put on UN badges, it became a NATO action.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if I check my history, I don't recall that the communist country of Yugoslavia ever joined NATO. Do you remember that?
As a matter of fact, I remember it did not. So we don't have a treaty under NATO with Yugoslavia, as far as I know. I could be wrong, but we might have had a contract or a treaty with a communist country. You know,
mm-hmm.
Wouldn't be the first time. But the bottom line is they're going to expend men, material, and tax dollars for no legitimate reason. So what's the illegitimate reason? Get American soldiers out of America. Because we all know American soldiers will not shoot Americans.
Exactly. I personally feel that that whole situation, well, we're going to digress here a little bit, but many people are familiar with Public Law 87297 and State Department Document 7277. Basically, these were brought out on the scene in the early 60s with John F. Kennedy, and it places a majority of American servicemen and women overseas, and their replacements are to be made up in the states here of foreigners. And I think we have that going on right under our very noses via this deception. But that's, you know, that's what it appears to be. But again, we digress. We're trying to keep ourselves free. We've got, you know, you've got the concept of liberty, and you've got different types of liberty. Maybe you can go into that a little bit.
Oh my, this is a very interesting word. We've all heard the Declaration of Independence talk about life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And most people think liberty is this vague, you know, freedom to do something, but that's not what it really means. In fact, the definition of liberty, coming from the English law, was permission. If you've ever been in the Navy, you know that term, shore liberty, which is what the captain gives to the crew, permission to leave the ship. In England, the king used to grant liberties to people, say, open a brewery or a factory or something, and that person had, in effect, a crown monopoly, because he had the king's permission and no one else did. So when the founding fathers said they wanted life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness, they were really saying is that we want the power to protect ourselves and without first asking for permission to act. So when you look at liberty, what they were really talking about is not freedom, but no need to get permission, which means licenses. All that stuff which we now suffer today is a violation of liberty. Furthermore, liberty is divided into four parts, and it's based upon where you're exercising it. Natural liberty is that which you exercise upon your own property. And your only limitation is natural law. You can do whatever you want on your own turf because that's where you're happiest, that's where you're free. But when you step out into the public sector, say a public road or whatnot, now you're limited. You have personal liberty, and you're limited by the prohibition to not mess with anybody else's rights. That makes sense. You stay to the right, he stays to his right, and you pass each other, you're fine. Then we come into the next two, which we all heard of, the American Civil Liberties Union. Civil liberty is a liberty or permission that you exercise when you get in contract with government. For instance, a doctor might apply for the civil liberty to commit manslaughter without going to jail. That's called a licensed MD. If a doctor kills his patient, he is not held criminally liable. And then the last form of liberty is political liberty. That's permission to join the government by signing up as a registered voter, as an elector, running for office or otherwise. So two of those, civil and political, are tied to the government granting you permission, and the other two are just natural and inherent rights you have, natural and personal.
Now, this is very intriguing because it goes back to the subtle brainwashing, and some of the not-so-subtle brainwashing that we've received, that the words appear to have changed definition over the years, and people misunderstand. One that kind of popped into my mind when you're discussing the political aspects is constituent.
Oh, yeah, that's a good one. Most people don't realize that a constituent is one who's given power of attorney to someone else. They think about that. Once you give power of attorney, that person's free to act without you coming and hounding them. And that's what happens. When you elect any official, he is now have with power of attorney, can make laws that obligate you, which is another reason why a free inhabitant who is not an elector and thus not exercising civil or political liberties is not bound by the laws.
Because they don't apply to him.
Exactly.
So, you know, the newspapers and the news tell you, oh, you need to register to vote. You want to be a constituent. Well, you really don't want to be a constituent, do you?
Absolutely not.
And that's part of the fun. We don't understand the language anymore, and we can't catch on with what they're really doing to us.
But we can catch on, obviously, because you have. It's just it's a matter of research. It's a matter of personal sacrifice.
Yeah. It's a simple thing, for instance, that most people don't know the difference between nationality and citizenship. We're all told we're U.S. citizens, but that's not true. To be a citizen, you have to submit. That means voluntarily agree. Because if you were forced to agree, that's involuntary servitude, and that's forbidden. So, again, claiming citizenship is a voluntary act, whereas nationality is based upon where you were born.
That's intriguing. I was talking with a gentleman at one point in time, and he was an older gentleman, and just referenced enlisting or being drafted for the Second World War. They, at that point in time, there were still many free inhabitants, okay? The war powers and all these other things hadn't been in effect that long. The question was, basically, if you're a United States citizen, step forward. And that was an admission. Those that knew better, they didn't take that step. And they said, thank you, you may go. Okay. Those that were aware, were knowledgeable of the fraud that was being perpetrated, knew the differences in citizenship. They didn't take their step, and then they went home.
That's right. I had a friend whose son did not get a Social Security number, and when he turned 18, he tried to register for Selective Service, and they threw him out.
Mm-hmm.
They said, you don't have the number, get out of here.
Mm-hmm. Well, he's not required to.
That's right.
Now, life gets difficult when you rescind these things. There was a recent court case, the Taco Bell case. Talk about that a little bit, so people understand that this is indeed a valid point.
Yes, I believe it was in Texas. A young gentleman, I believe he was 15 or 16, got a job at Taco Bell and did not have a Social Security number. About the third or fourth day, the computer caught up and burped out a little pink slip and said, well, if you don't come up with the number, you're fired. So he was let loose, and his father started a paper campaign, and the bottom line was the company capitulated, offered, I believe, an out-of-court settlement, and offered him employment the next year when the child was again home for summer vacation. And to this day, Taco Bell applications have the word optional under Social Security number. So you can get a copy of that application from good old Taco Bell and take it to your other employer and say, see, they say it's optional. Don't you tell me it's mandatory.
Mm-hmm.
Or I'll take you to court like they did.
Exactly. And it is possible to operate in society. It's not easy. It's difficult. But again, it's a personal thing. If you really and truly wish to make a difference in what's going on with this nation, it's a matter of learning and doing. It's like Bill, putting basically his life on the line frequently, getting a lot of information out. People aren't aware of some of the things that happened to him. Although you haven't been threatened, Jeff, you do have a fair amount of aggravation at times from these entities, more because of you doing what you do and helping others.
Yes, I generally, I've been blessed with minimal problems because I tread the path in such a fashion. My boss, the Jewish carpenter, what he says goes.
Mm-hmm.
And, most people in government really respect that. They leave you alone if you're a true believer. There are those who put the mantle of religion about their shoulders when, in fact, that they really don't have a committed view. And I think they sense that. They're like, they can sense that insincerity.
Mm-hmm. Or maybe this guy, there's a chink here. This guy's not really committed. We can twist him. We can break him. And it's all part of the bureaucratic function and the fiefdoms that they establish for themselves. And it becomes a game. Don't acquiesce. Don't give them the satisfaction. Don't give them jurisdiction. And stand your ground, and you'll be just fine. And Jeff's living proof of that. So is Bill. So are 46 million others. But unfortunately, if you don't do it right, like others that recently found out, you'll go to jail. A lot of talk about the Constitution. Where does the Constitution stand right now? War Powers and Emergency Act, all these other things, this bankruptcy, the rest of it.
Well, Eugene Schroeder did a lot of good research, but I think he missed a point, because if you carefully read the law, it only applies to U.S. citizens in U.S. territory. And again, the Federal Reserve is an instrumentality of the United States government. So when you do get a bank account now you are in federal territory, subject to that jurisdiction. But again, if you're out of it, it doesn't apply. So yes, the War Powers Act, yes, there is an abrogation of the Constitution, but again, they're all legitimate. They're impaired status and contractual in nature.
So basically, these people in Washington, technically, they're operating legally then.
Exactly. They are trying to avoid the taint of treason every which way they can.
Mm-hmm.
They're almost like vampires that wait for you to ask them to treat you bad.
Mm-hmm. And that's all part and parcel of what we need to recognize. Again, we give them the power by being fearful and the rest of it. If we recognize that they need to maintain a veil of legitimacy and we are eternally vigilant, we can change things.
That's correct.
If we pull, like we discussed last night, pull our resources from their system, don't allow them through factional reserve to inflate an imaginary money supply. If we do some things, we can. It's very simple to win this back. And if we recognize that they need to maintain that veil of legitimacy and we're constantly on guard, we can catch things before they occur and stuff it right back down their throats.
I often say the government is a public servant. They are not a public master. And often servants can make mistakes, so I don't condemn them outright. And I just tell them, someday when enough people learn about it, we're going to come to you and say, Congress, tell us where the creditor is, and we will protect you from him. And that would be fun. I'd like to see maybe 90 million people show up on Washington, D.C. doorstep, fully armed, saying, it's okay, Congress, we'll protect you. Where's the creditor?
Well, exactly. I have found it's much easier to work with honey. Matter of fact, I was talking to a California congressman a couple days ago, and I referred him to you, because he was discussing the possible bankruptcy of the United States. It's like, well, sir, were you aware that the United States is already bankrupt and that it's been operating under Chapter 11? He says, well, I've heard those rumors. Where can I get verification? Well, you know, went on about that. But then I asked him, I said, well, what about the War Powers and Emergency Act? Are you familiar with it? So that's, we get more mail on that subject than anything else. A lot of it is nutcase mail. People need to understand, if they approach it politely with facts and with, you know, just quality statements and don't rant and rave, we will affect positive change. Don't make yourself into a nutcase.
Yeah. In fact, it's better to ask a question than to make a statement. If you believe that your research shows that the Federal Reserve is a private corporation, don't say, what are you guys, what fraud you're perpetrating, saying the Federal Reserve is federal. You should be asking a simple question. Is the Federal Reserve a private or a public corporation? And if so, who owns the stock? Okay, you didn't make a claim, you just asked them a question. And it's going to make them think, uh-oh, maybe the cat's out of the bag.
Mm-hmm.
Is it true that the Secretary of Treasury is governor of the fund? Is it true that the governor of the fund is not paid by the United States? Therefore, is it true the Secretary of Treasury doesn't work for the United States? Who does he work for? Who pays him? The fund, the bank. And who are the fiduciary agents? The Federal Reserve Corporation. Oh. You just ask simple questions and they'll start getting the message.
Oh, it'll be real plain and simple and clear. And the more of us that do that, and again, don't act militant. Unfortunately, it appears that the time is coming soon when militancy will be required. But in the meantime, we cannot allow them an excuse. Well, we're doing this because you people are crazy. We're doing this because of people like Tim McVeigh. Or we're doing this because of these rampant militias. We need to operate very quietly, wise as the serpent, but quiet as the lamb. And we will affect positive change, but we also need to be prepared on many, many levels. And that includes knowledge. Knowledge is power. Knowledge will set us free, as Jeff has obviously pointed out.
Yeah, and make sure folks know how to get in touch with Swiss America, because that's good knowledge there.
Yeah, and for those that need further information, just get a hold of me, Frank, at Swiss America. We'll be able to help you out with that. We can get you some material in your hands that will start your educational process. That economic solutions book that we've been putting out for a long time now is excellent. There's a lot of other things that we do that can get to broaden your knowledge base, and you can just give me a ring and I can help you with all of that. Jeff, as we're winding down here, I think we're going to lose our hookup in a couple minutes here. Do you have anything you want to close with?
Well, remember, folks, the legalized slavery that they imposed was done by your consent. And as you gave consent, you can take it away. And that is the true power, because the Declaration of Independence says government's powers derive from your consent. Don't be fooled. If you think you give consent in the electoral booth, pulling that lever, just figure out, how can you say no? When you show me you can say no in a voter's booth, then you have the power of consent. As far as I can find, all you can do is vote for the lesser of evils. The only people who can say no are the free inhabitants who have moved away from all those privileges of political and civil liberty and exercising natural and personal liberty.
And are not fooled by stock markets, are not operating from greed. And, well, I got 33% on my mutual fund last year. Well, you're a slave. You got your slaves that got 33% of an IOU. Is that true wealth, or is freedom true wealth?
That's right.
Freedom, bottom line, isn't free.
If they owned it, the government wouldn't be able to tax it or take it from them. That's the bottom line. You think about it. If you really own something and control it, they can't make it a law. And you notice there are laws against suicide. That tells you you don't own yourself in the eyes of the law. Because if you did, it wouldn't matter if you killed yourself.
It's a rather ridiculous thing to make a law against suicide. I mean, what are they going to prosecute, even if you still are in the system? Of course, it wouldn't surprise me. I mean, they have done some very stupid things as of late. All right, people, I'd like to thank you very much this evening for listening. I hope you've enjoyed these things, this information that Jeff has shared with y'all. Anything further I can help you with in that regard, just please call me at Swiss America. I'll do my best in that regard, and we will take it from there. Jeff, thank you very much for being on board.
I really appreciate it. God bless the United States of America.
There you go. Good night, everybody, and we'll be talking to you tomorrow evening. I've got some personal things I'd like to share with you all based upon some knowledge I've derived from friends in the military. Some things about preparedness I think will be wise to go over with at this stage of the game. Thanks again, and we'll talk to you all tomorrow night. Bye-bye. Good night, Jeff.
Good night.